This is Darian Sahanaja of the band known as Wonderments, and you're listening to 90.7 FM, WGXC Accra.
Tune in Monday, June 27th to all sorts of creative community voices on the air at WGXC, including at 9 a.m. Hear from Bob Cohen from the group Citizen Action, explaining how citizens can comment on New York's proposed climate law. 10 a.m. hop on the Afrosonic Taxi. Tracks this week from Herencia de Tumbuki, Burkina Aza, and Katie Diarra, among others. At 11 a.m., Brendan Donegan is playing favorites live from the WGXC Hudson Studio in the basement of the First Presbyterian Church. He'll feature the music of Milton Nascimento on until noon, when it's time for the Deep Three show after the local news, with music from Laurie Anderson, Meredith Monk, and Sarah Manning, among others. 3 p.m., Jerome Cooper is the featured artist on Roulette Intermedium's Tracking the Odds show. At 7 p.m., it's time for Law and Disorder. And at 8 p.m., Rob Van Irv hosts the Everything All the Time music show on 90.7 WGXC. You can find all about the Hudson-based circus, the Bindlesif Family Circus, on the WGXC community calendar. They're hosting the Bindlesif Circus's Summer of Joy 2022 in Hudson, with 5 different programs for youth ages 6 through young adults, including circus art intensives for youth and participation in the Hudson Black Arts and Cultural Festival parade. Also work on costume design and fabrication. They host the Hudson Juggling Club at Waterfront Wednesdays in Hudson, and a restorative justice facilitation training with the Hudson Youth Center and the Restorative Center of Newburgh. These programs run from June 29th to August 24th. You can find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
Wave Farm programs are made possible in part by the New York State Council on the Arts, with the support of the New York State Legislature, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts, the Greene County Legislature through the County Initiative Program, administered in Greene County by CREATE, the Alexander and Marjorie Hoover Foundation, the T. Backer Fund, the Joseph Family Charitable Trust, and hundreds of other generous individual donors, including WGXC's sustaining supporters, who provide critical monthly support to Wave Farm's radio station, WGXC 90.7 FM. Thank you.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Spike's Record Rack in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
Info. Music. Signals. News, fun and frolic, and emergency instructions.
90.7 FM, WGXC.
I'm Tom Rowe in Accra, and I'm now joined by, I didn't ask your pronunciation, so let's see how I do. Anna Plattner and Justin Wexler from, where is it, Wild Hudson Valley. I want to say Hudson Valley Wild, but Wild Hudson Valley.
There is a Hudson Valley Wild.
I know. That's why I got it mixed up. I Googled, and I got both things. And I was like, which one is which? So you guys are Wild Hudson Valley.
Wild
yes.
Hudson Valley.
And you're in Cairo. And so tell people what Wild Hudson Valley is.
So I started Wild Hudson Valley after I graduated from Bard with a master's in education. I really needed to get out of the classroom and into the outdoors, which is where I've been teaching since I was a teenager. And it started off as basically a side thing. So I started this a few years before Anna joined me. And I would basically do presentations for historical societies and nature walks for conservation organizations in Columbia, Albany, Green, Ulster, Dutchess County, and in various parts of the Hudson Valley. I was joined by Anna a couple of years later, and over time we have turned this into a very much full-time endeavor. Do you want to go a little bit into what we do and our...
Yeah, so like Justin said, it started out very much doing educational programs on nature, ecology, the human and environmental history of the area, mostly working with other like land trusts, conservation organizations. But when the pandemic came, we decided that we really wanted to start hosting on our own property. So in Caro, my family has had land there. I grew up in the area, and my family has had a 90-acre property that we pretty much use for recreation. And Justin and I started farming there in 2015. And we grow all different medicinal herbs. And we have a small forest farm where we do edible mushrooms, nut crops, fruit trees. Last year, for the first time, we opened up programming on our own property, which really allowed us to teach exactly what we wanted to teach and do more hands-on workshops and go into forest farming more. My background is more in natural resources. I graduated from Cornell in natural resources and got very much into forest farming after I graduated. Justin and I met, we got to know each other through working at American Ginseng Farm, a large-scale wild simulated ginseng operation. Ginseng is a little forest understory herb that's native to the Catskills, and it's one of the many medicinal crops that we grow. So since then, we decided to start hosting overnight guests on the property. So not just doing daytime programs, but weekend-long nature camps for people of all ages. So that's the endeavor we're starting right now. We're actually only just 10 minutes away from here, just down in Caro. And this is our opening weekend for what we're calling our eco camp. So.
Oh, boy.
Someone's excited about your eco camp. So what happens at your eco camp? Is it for kids or is it for adults? Is it for people from around here? Is it people from the city or is it all those things?
Everybody is welcome. We try to do this in a way so that people from different demographics, different backgrounds can get equal access to getting out to the outdoors and really immersing themselves. For our overnights, overnight stays, we're ironing that all out right now. But in general, like, we still offer many public workshops, we just want to get people more comfortable with the outdoors. And really our mission is to connect people with the past of the Hudson Valley. So Anna, had mentioned that her background is in natural resources and agroforestry. Now, while my career is in environmental education, my background is really in ethnohistory. So I've spent really my entire life studying the life of the native people who lived in the Hudson Valley in the pre-contact period and their history as they were forced west over the past 300 years. I've made many connections with people in their descendant communities and made many friends with them in Ontario, Wisconsin, Oklahoma. And so what we're doing is by connecting the present with the past, with people who knew how to live with the land here, who know how to connect with it in the right way. We're hoping to try to bring modern people who don't have those connections with the natural world and foster that so that, people start to care about the world and connect with other species, for example, or with the landscape in a way that they might not have otherwise.
Yeah, so So you teach that at the Eco Camp, or?
Yeah, we go into a little bit of everything. So we will host guests on occasion as well. But for an example of a weekend itinerary, Friday night, our campers will, you know, gather around a communal fire, and we'll talk about traditional star lore, as well as bringing in Western science as well. Talk about the different night sounds that we're hearing. During the day, we'll have programming, which includes nature walks, but they're not just any nature walk. While we are looking at the different species around us, we are also learning to read the landscape and see what stories it can tell us. So that includes how different trees, for example, what they can provide for people and how they provided for the native people who live here and for their descendants today. Or, you know, different bird species we encountered, there are stories that go behind their names in local indigenous languages. In addition, you know, we often will lead tourists through our forest farming operations. So we'll get to show people how you can make, you know, how you can sustain yourself using some of these more modern innovations in agroforestry off of older forests without having, you know, the need to cut the forest, because a lot of landowners end up cutting their woods in order to pay their taxes. And we'll have night walks for the public. I mentioned guests coming in. So we're still ironing out how many guests we're having this year, but this coming weekend, which is our opening weekend, we'll have Misty Cook, who's a Mohican herbalist from the Mohican Reservation in Wisconsin, and she'll be doing a presentation and walk on traditional medicines. A friend of ours, a Lenape elder from the Moravian Town Reserve in Ontario, will be visiting in August doing a corn husk doll workshop. We're also hoping to have various historians, geologists, mushroom crazy people come and, well, how else do you describe people who are
mushroom fanatics?
Mushroom fanatics.
They're fanatic. The people that are into like wild mushrooms are really fanatical about it, aren't they?
We've been growing mushrooms on in the forest farm for years now.
Edible mushrooms. And medicinal, but not the fun mushrooms.
I think Labor Day weekend, we're planning a shiitake mushroom inoculation workshop. So teaching people how to grow their own shiitake mushrooms. But then we'll also go on a mushroom identification walk and make like a whole weekend, a mushroom weekend on Labor Day. So...
yeah, maybe after the rain the next couple of days, we might see... I haven't seen any wild mushrooms in the forest yet this year.
Yeah, we've been... there's an invasive... well, I say invasive. We don't know for sure, but it seems very aggressive. Species of mushroom called golden oyster mushrooms. They're bright yellow on the top and white gills on the underside. And for over 7-8 years now, almost 10 years, we've been getting... a lot of them growing on all the elm trees that have died from elm phloem necrosis. So we had sort of a mass wipe out of the elm trees, and these mushrooms came in. I say that they're invasive just because they're not actually native to North America. They're an escaped cultivar. So people were growing them on mushroom farms, and the spores escaped and went feral. And so we've been finding a lot of those this past month. The season's about... over though,
yeah,
but this rain might trigger one more flush, and then when the temperatures start to warm up even more, then we'll start to get chanterelle and a lot of the summer
black
mushrooms.
Trumpets should be coming up soon.
Yeah,
I think last year we had like the biggest chanterelle. It was either last year or the year before. It was largest chanterelle crop on our property here that I've seen in ever since we've been here. I think last year was
a pretty good year.
Yeah, that was true all
the
over.
Summer, 2018, the summer we got married, was a really big year, too.
Yeah, that
we
was
were
great.
Able to serve them at our wedding because we found so many. It was kind of a fun thing.
It's neat that you're bringing this sort of programming and bringing like the past into the future and the present. When Caro has all this... amazing past history, this ancient forest that they found a couple years ago, that is like it's the oldest forest ever discovered or something, older than the Gilboa forest, I guess.
Yeah,
Yeah, I know. And it's like behind the dump, or not the dump,
the highway
apartment.
I visited there
where the
snow plows
are. Yeah.
I forgot you've been there.
Yeah, I was there when I was working at Cooperative Extension. We went back there just to check it out. And yeah, it really is remarkable to see all these petrified stumps on the ground and just to know how ancient they are.
Mm-hmm.
We just found a piece of mudstone on the creek, actually, and it looked like there were fossilized leaves on it, which is kind of trippy to think that there, you know, there was many times over the many millions of years there have been swamps here with giant tree ferns or bald cypress type trees. I don't even know what they were. It's wild to see evidence of that.
Yeah, driving around here, I'm constantly thinking of the giant glaciers that just carved everything. Everything is carved out by glaciers here.
Mm-hmm. Not every time, but since I was a kid. So I grew up in Hudson and got to see, you know, one of the best views of the Catskill Mountain escarpment pretty much every single day. And since I was a kid, I've always liked to imagine that point in time, 15,000 years ago or so, when the glaciers had gotten to a point where the Catskill Mountains' highest peaks were islands in an ocean of ice, and how wild that must have been. I couldn't even imagine what it would have been like to stand on these little islands just with ice in every direction.
It's crazy. Amazing to think about. What are people most surprised about when you're teaching them about plants that are here, or what have we forgotten about that? There's so many things that Native Americans, used medicinally that have sort of been lost over time.
So one thing that I find really amazing is that the Native people who call this region their ancestral land and who now live primarily in Ontario and Wisconsin have, even with all that they've lost in their exodus west, have held on to a wealth of plant knowledge. And I've met many people who are very, very generous in sharing with me how they use plants for different purposes. And combining that with many years of archival research, I've been putting together a huge database since I started in 2004 to try to understand their relationship with plants in the past. And I think what blows the public's mind is how virtually every native plant species we encounter has some recorded use. A point I'll make, especially to kids, when I'm getting kids out in the woods, is if you need glue, the forest has it for you right there. If you need fiber for making a fishing line or rope, it's right there. If you need to dye things different colors, everything is there. And we really focus also on having people touch the plants and smell them and sometimes taste them, which I find to be one of the best ways to memorize these different species. It's something that we're so focused on visuals in our society that we forget, I was going to be cheesy and say to stop and smell the roses, but literally, our brains are wired, like we've connected with plants for, a million years longer. Our human and pre-human ancestors lived very close to the environment. And we are made to memorize these kind of things. You just have to learn how to do it. So bringing in, for example, and I'll wrap up in a second, but the local native languages like Mohican, Algonquian languages are extremely descriptive, even poetic in how they construct words. And their languages are really a key to understanding their relationship with the landscape, including plant names or animal names. And it's one way that I used in teaching, that both Anna and I use, in teaching people on the uses of different plants and way to memorize them is through their native names, which often unlock a lot about them. So I think that's one of the things that people really amazes people, I think.
I think we need to hear an example.
I don't know.
Can you come up with putting you on the spot?
Well, I think a neat one maybe is the word for mountain laurel. It literally translates as spoon tree or spoon making tree. And the wood is when it actually takes on it's very fine grained and takes a fine polish. So it was a preferred wood for making the large wooden spoons that are traditional to Native people in the Northeast. they made fun of European of white people spoons a lot back in the day. By the way, they said that you must have been exhausting for the number of times you need to lift it up and down to your mouth, because traditional native spoons are kind of like a small bowl with a handle that gets passed down through the generations because they're carved very beautifully. So that's an example. I think, you know, we call it mountain laurel based on its location, that it's evergreen, location of where they're generally found, but their name for it describes the fact that it's the best wood for wooden spoons. So maybe not the best example. It's what came to mind, though. And they're in full bloom right now, by the way.
What else is rampant right now?
I guess
strawberry season is just about ending.
Yeah, that's winding down, and except at the high elevations. Mulberries are ripening, although if you find a native mulberry, you're really lucky. We've only come across one or two ever in the Hudson Valley. They've been hybridized out by Asian mulberries.
Cattail shoots are really good for picking right now. You want to, you know, when cattails are just coming up on the edges of ponds or in marshes or swamps, the inner part of the shoots, when they're maybe like a quarter to halfway full grown, can be harvested and eaten like bamboo shoots or bamboo hearts. They're really tender and great on the inside. So that's another one that's perfect right now.
A lot of greens right now.
Reishi mushrooms as well are just about ready to be harvested in hemlock woods. So, yeah, these are all the types of things that we talk about on our guided walks and on the workshops and at our new eco camp.
And it seems like a lot of this is sort of becoming popular in different old things and fixing things, like the DIY movement, and the state legislature even passed a right to repair bill so that you don't waste all these products. I'm just wondering if, like, there's been, like, the flavor of the day, like ramps were really big a couple years ago. Is there a problem with, like, people picking too many ramps or hurting the thing because they become popular?
So that is a risk, especially mostly on public lands. So if we're talking about ramps in particular, they're a very slow-growing forest understory plant. From seed, a plant might not actually get to the stage where it's starting to produce its own seed and where it's mature and reproductive for like 8 or plus years. So you can imagine that if one person comes through and harvests most of an area, it won't be able to repopulate itself fast enough to keep up with that. And that's why ramps are particularly vulnerable. But personally, we know of many private properties where there are multiple acres of solid ramps. And in those circumstances, personally, we don't have a problem with harvesting the bulbs of ramps. It's very easy to harvest ramps sustainably. We actually, towards the end of May, we had a ramp stewardship workshop, because that's a very popular issue right now in terms of
ramp shaming.
Ramp shaming is a real thing.
First ramps were popular, and now ramp shaming is popular.
Yes, exactly. And there's a lot of misinformation in terms of, for example, the popular narrative is to harvest only one leaf per plant. But if you think about that, a ramp plant only has 1 to 3 leaves a year, and they only photosynthesize for about a month, a little bit more. And if you're taking 50% of that plant's ability to photosynthesize for the year, you know, that over time is going to weaken the plant, like if you do that every year. And the plant most likely will not have the energy to produce seed, and it might not divide clonally, because ramps also spread just like garlic, where they'll produce more like little bulbs off of the side, because it's an allium species. So that's not really the answer. Harvesting one leaf per plant is way oversimplifying a larger stewardship practice. And so we had this workshop earlier this year where we talked about also dividing plants, where they're all growing in a clump. You can spread them out and allow each plant to grow multiple bulbs over the course of the years. You can also plant seeds. And a combination of all of these stewardship practices is really the best way to manage ramps. You just got to be really careful on public lands because you don't know who else is also harvesting. And it's in those circumstances where you can have a complete collapse of a population very quickly.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Anna Plattner and Justin Wexler from Wild Hudson Valley in Cairo. And I'm wondering if you can sense this at all on the local level, but is climate change affecting things here in the Hudson Valley? I mean, it happens slowly, so it's sort of difficult to tell, but it seems like in the past 10 or 15 years, the storms have gotten more severe and more often. It seems like other things are happening. What are your opinions?
I'm sure. And it's, you know, invasive species are an easy way to tell. So with hemlock woolly adelgids, when we have really, really strong cold snaps in the winter, like below zero temperatures for multiple nights, that really sets back some invasive insect species that are killing off some of our native tree species. And as we get milder winters, their populations are expanding northward and causing declines in hemlocks, as an example. Notwithstanding the polar vortex thing that seems to be happening and is connected with climate change. I mean, it's hard to say. I've paid pretty good attention to what's going on in Green, Columbia, Albany County area since I was a kid and started nature journaling. And I have noticed many changes during the time that maybe could be linked with climate change, like bird species that have moved north. So when I was a kid, you would never have seen a black vulture in the Hudson Valley or a Carolina wren. Those are among multiple species that have shifted their ranges northward, maybe because of milder winters. It's hard to say. But I think we are definitely going to see increasingly dramatic impacts over the next decades. We are in kind of lucky that the Northeast is in a little bit of a better place than parts of the West or, the lower Mississippi Valley for what's being forecast in terms of droughts and wet bulbs and all the horrible things that are happening. So,
yeah, what is it? 20% of the country? I thought I saw this week there was a day 20% of the country had temperatures over 100 degrees.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
And it's not summer yet.
No.
And the longhorn tick, the Texas tick, is now here, too?
The Lone Star.
The Lone Star, that's what it is.
Yeah, longhorn, yeah. Longhorn, Lone Star.
Yeah, we've been finding Texas them. Words. We found them on us for a few years. I mean, I've often wondered whether there's a conspiracy. I don't know, have you heard of that they can spread a virus that can give you a sensitivity to red meat?
That's a fact. That's yeah. A thing, yeah.
But I wonder whether there's a conspiracy that somebody, bioengineered this to try to make society allergic to red meat, reduce red meat consumption, and maybe reduce emissions of methane and carbon dioxide.
I'm sure that theory exists on the internet, yes. Somewhere. Someone is saying it. So what haven't you told us about Wild Hudson Valley?
Well, we talked a bit about our guided walks and all the different subjects that we teach about. And we mentioned the eco camp, but we didn't get in so much into our lives right now, 24/7, are preparing for our opening weekend this weekend. So we have four campsites on the property, and each campsite comes with its own canvas bell tent with a queen bed and two twin beds inside. So we're kind of borderline glamping, although we're not while we provide a lot of amenities that a traditional glamping place would, that's because we want to accommodate people who may not have any camping equipment, who might be coming from, another city, New York City. And so we provide a lot of these amenities, but we're not necessarily going for the champagne on ice vibe. It's more the we want everyone to be comfortable, even if you've never camped before. Mm-hmm. That's a real goal of ours, is to immerse people in nature in a way that they can feel comfortable and confident. So We've been getting these tents set up, and we are building a gathering space. It's a canvas roofed pavilion with a fire pit underneath for our Friday night campfire, where we're going to do stargazing and storytelling. And we've been getting our trail network already, finally putting the signs up.